The Texan's greatest disadvantage lay in his horse and his horsemanship. American horses tended to be work plugs, plodding and incapable of running with the fleet, tough, and nimble Indian ponies. Frontier people did possess some finely bred horses, but most of them were too fragile to be ridden over many miles of hard terrain. Over short distances, it was impossible for any white horseman to outdistance a Comanche Mustang. Over long distances, Indian horses had the advantage of eating forage, cottonwood bark, among other things, and grass, as opposed to the grain the settlers' horses ate. Even properly mounted, though, the whites were not the riders the Indians were. In the woodlands of the East, they had not ridden much because the distances between places were nowhere near what they were in Texas, and they certainly had no idea how to fight in the saddle or to shoot accurately from a moving horse. Comanches fought entirely on horseback and in a way no soldier or citizen in North America had ever seen. Consider the classic attack on a stationary enemy. The warriors formed themselves into a wedge-shaped mass, which then morphed with great precision and at high speed into the shape of a huge wheel without spokes, whose rim consisted of one or more moving lines of warriors, wheels within wheels. As described by Wallace and Hobel, the ring, winding around with machine-like regularity, approached nearer and nearer with each revolution. As a warrior approached the point on the circle nearest the enemy, he dropped into the loop around his horse's neck and shot arrows from beneath the neck. If his horse was shot down, he generally landed on his feet. No American or Texan on a work plug could ever be a match for that sort of buzzing horde. Few Indian tribes ever were. The Comanches had been fighting that way for 200 years. They engaged in this sort of combat as a way of life, against lethal and highly mobile opponents. War was what they did, and all of their social status was based on it. The conquest of the Apaches over a generation had caused a profound change in Comanche life. Before, hunting meat had been the transcendent purpose of their existence. Now, it was making war, and the people had developed a hunger for it. Most of their warfare was unseen by white men. But we have a few accounts from the era to remind us of what the Comanches were doing when they were not raiding white settlements. Former captive Herman Lehman tells of a battle, probably typical in many ways of Indian fights, between Apaches and Comanches that raged for a full day, with great carnage on both sides. The Apaches lost 25 braves on the first day, the Comanches probably more than that. The next day, the Comanches mounted another furious attack on horseback, this time killing 40 more warriors and slaughtering all of the Apache women and children. In another account by a former captive, 1,800 mounted Blackfeet clashed with 1,200 mounted Comanches in a 6-hour battle that featured ferocious hand-to-hand combat. The Comanches whipped their opponents and reclaimed the 3,000 horses the Blackfeet had stolen. This was the sort of war without quarter they were now raining down on the hapless white farmers of the western frontier. The only real chance they had was to circle the wagons or the horses and hope they could kill enough Indians to make it too costly for them to continue. Mostly, the settlers did not stand a chance.
The Texan solution to these problems, ranging companies, was unique in Western military history. That was largely because, by anyone else's standards, the companies made no sense at all. They violated every rule of military organization and protocol, every standard of hierarchy that allowed a traditional army to function. They fit no known category. They were neither police, nor regular army, nor militia. They had been officially organized in 1835 and 1836 behind the thunderous oratory of Cynthia Ann's uncle, Daniel Parker, who became the prime mover in their establishment. They had meant to step into the void left by the army that had fought at San Jacinto, almost all of which had been furloughed by 1837. The plan had looked good on paper. 600 mounted gunmen, Parker's legislation referred to them as rangers, the first official use of that word, were commissioned to hunt Indians and defend the frontier. But in reality, the tiny, resourceless government provided neither guns, nor men, nor mounts. It provided no uniforms, provisions, or barracks. There were never anywhere near 600 men that could be classified as rangers. Often 50 was more like it, sometimes 100. And because there was no formal political organization around them, no one was designated to appoint officers. They arose casually and by acclaim, and solely on merit. The rank and file gave them their commissions. In the absence of provisions, rangers hunted for themselves, often going into the field with only water and a mixture of sugar and parched corn they called cold flour. Sometimes they were given food by the communities they defended. Sometimes they stole chickens. The only thing the government reliably provided, in its wisdom, was ammunition. Oddly, considering the fact that almost nothing was given them, there seems to have been no real problem with recruitment. The western part of Texas in those years was awash in young, reckless, single men with a taste for wide open spaces, danger, and raw adventure. They were almost all in their 20s, and they came to San Antonio looking for something other than a comfortable, sedentary life on a farm. They liked the idea of killing Comanches and Mexicans. Most of the famous ranger captains had completed their careers by the time they were 32. They had no property other than their horses, and often no steady jobs. Without them, the idea of ranging companies would never have worked. They were happy to stay in the field for 3 to 6 months, the usual length of a ranger commission. It was this semi-permanence that made them different from militia. On this seemingly nonsensical model, Texas's primitive Indian fighting organizations developed in the years 1836 to 1840. The rangers were simply what was needed, and they grew organically from that premise. They began to patrol the frontier, looking for Comanches to kill. Since they were untried young men and did not know any better, they adapted quickly to this lethal new world of horses and weapons and Indian tactics. But they did not learn quickly enough to prevent appalling losses. The story of these first informal attempts to fight the Comanches will never be fully understood. That is because almost all of them went unrecorded. The new frontier folks, especially the ranger types, were not literate, and they were not thinkers. They would rarely even acknowledge their victories, as whites were always falling all over themselves to do in the West, even when all they did was avoid disaster, let alone their defeats. The rangers were just a dirty, ill-clad, underfed squad of irregulars anyway. They didn't write letters and didn't keep diaries. They rarely issued reports of any kind. Often they didn't tell anyone at all what they had done. There were no journalists around either, of the sort who would later chronicle, with detail and considerable fanfare, the Indian battles of the 1870s. The few reporters in East Texas towns like Houston, Richmond, and Clarksville would not begin to grasp who the Rangers were, or what they had accomplished, or how they had changed American warfare, until after the outbreak of the Mexican War in 1846. The little that is known about what happened on the frontier during the years of the Republic comes from a handful of memoirists who participated in it and wrote it down only later. From the evidence that does exist, however, it is apparent that many young men died fighting Comanches in battles that must have been cruelly one-sided. Ranger John Caperton estimated that about half the Rangers were killed off every year, and that the lives of those who went into the service were not considered good for more than a year or two. He also wrote that of the 140 young men in San Antonio in 1839, 100 of them were killed in various fights with Indians and Mexicans. Most would have been killed by Indians. Those are very large numbers in a town with a population of only 2,000. There is a sense, when one reads histories of the battle at Plum Creek, or of the bloody Moor raid that followed it, that the Texans quickly mastered the art of anti-Comanche warfare. This is not true. Plum Creek was a fiasco brought on as much by Buffalo Hump's failure to control his army and to stop them from looting as it was by the bravery of Texas fighters. Moore's success on the Colorado was entirely the result of surprise. The Comanches did not yet believe the white man would come after them in their homelands. Colonel Moore's first, near-disastrous attack on a Comanche camp offers a better look at what most of those early engagements might have looked like. So does Captain John Byrd's scouting expedition, which left Fort Milam on the Brazos River near Belton, Texas, on May 27, 1839, with 31 rangers. Hunting for depredating Indians, they came upon a group of 27 of them skinning buffalo. Pleased at their marvelous good luck, the white men spurred toward them, and the Comanches, of course, fled, because it was not their way ever to receive any sort of charge. The rangers then gave chase and pursued them for 3 miles. Their horses, as usual, were no match for the Comanche ponies, so they gave up and headed back to the fort. Now, however, they began to notice that the Comanches had turned too. Suddenly, the Comanches were pursuing them. In the words of one officer, they were hurling their arrows upon us from every direction. And there were 40 of them. Byrd then made the sort of error that experienced Comanche fighters would later never make. He fled like a scared jackrabbit. On the open prairie, that might have been the end of his company, especially since the Indian force, led by none other than Buffalo Hump, had now grown to some 300. But Byrd got lucky. He and his fleeing company came upon a ravine that offered cover. What followed was typical of ranger battles of the day. The white men took cover, the Indians charged, the men on both sides died, and the Indians finally withdrew, unwilling to take the losses it would require to pry the white men with their fire-spitting Kentucky rifles from their positions. Also typical was the way the white man spun it. Byrd actually managed to claim victory, even though he was dying when he did so. 6 of his soldiers died too. Others were wounded. He had taken 30% or more casualties. The reality was that the ravine had saved him and his men from outright slaughter. One can imagine many such moments on the prairie, every one of them lost to history, in which gallant pursuing rangers became desperate fleeing rangers, and in which no ravine was found, and they all died quickly, or if they were unlucky enough not to die quickly, were slowly tortured to death by fire and other means. They were learning about that, too. Veteran Indian fighters were widely believed to save one bullet for themselves, though there is only one recorded instance of it. In 1855, U.S. infantry officer Sam Cherry's horse fell on him in a fight with Comanches. Pinned, he calmly shot 5 times at his attackers, then, surrounded by exulting Indians, he turned the gun to his temple for the last shot. The Rangers were a rough bunch. They drank hard and liked killing and fist-fighting and knife-fighting and executing people they deemed criminals or enemies. As time went by, and so many of them were killed, creating a sort of natural selection in their ranks, they got even rougher, more brutal, and more aggressive. They looked the part, too. Though the idealized ranger wore a leather hat with its brim turned up, a kerchief, cotton shirt, and plain breeches, the reality was something else. They wore whatever pleased them. Sometimes that meant colorful Mexican serapes and wide-brimmed sombreros. Sometimes fur hats, bob-tailed coats, or dirty Panamas. Often it meant head-to-toe buckskins or bits and pieces of buffalo robes. Some went about naked to the waist, wearing the equivalent of Indian breech clouts over leggings. Many were large, physically imposing men with thick, brawny arms, long hair, and full beards. They had names like Bigfoot Wallace, he was truly huge and a savage fighter, Alligator Davis, because he had wrestled one to a draw on the Medina River, and Old Paint Caldwell, because his skin was so mottled it looked like peeling paint. Seen from the more civilized parts of 19th century America, they occupied a place in the social order just this side of brigands and desperados. They were not who you wanted to pick a fight with in a frontier saloon. And so it was remarkable that this group of violent, illiterate, and unmanageable border ruffians should give its full and unswerving allegiance to a quiet, slim-hipped 23-year-old with a smooth boyish face and sad eyes and a clear high voice who looked younger than his years. His name was John Coffee Hayes. He was called Jack. The Comanches, who feared him greatly, called him Captain Yak, as did the Mexicans, who put a high price on his head. He was the Uber Ranger, the one everyone wanted to be like, the one who was braver and smarter and cooler under fire than any of the rest of them. He was one of the finest military commanders America has ever produced, a fact that San Antonians suspected as early as the late 1830s, but the rest of the world would not learn until the Mexican War, when he became a national hero and his terrifying Rangers passed almost instantly into myth. Though he fought on the Texas frontier and Mexico for less than 12 years, he personally put an indelible stamp not only on the Texas Rangers, an organization that might be said to have arisen in imitation of him, but also the American West. There is a photograph taken of him in 1865, when he was 48, and it tells you everything about him. The face is still boyish, the hair thick and swept back, the features regular and moderately handsome, and generally unexceptional, except for one absolutely striking characteristic: his eyes. They are deep, wise, dead calm, a bit sad, and even from a distance of 140 years, riveting. They are the eyes of a man who is not afraid of anything. He was the first great Indian fighter on the plains frontier. He was the legend that spawned 1,000 other legends, dime novels, and Hollywood movies. He was born in Little Cedar Lick, Tennessee, in 1817, into a prosperous family of soldiers. His grandfather served with Andrew Jackson during the Indian Wars and later sold Jackson his famous home, the Hermitage. Hayes's father also served under Jackson and named his son for one of Jackson's most trusted officers, John Coffee. Like many other young men looking for adventure, especially Tennesseans, young Jack migrated to Texas after the Battle of San Jacinto, arriving in San Antonio probably in 1838, where he soon found work as a surveyor. Surveying in those years was the actual mechanism by which the settlers pushed their way westward into Indian lands. After independence, Texas gave to new settlers a sort of land grant known as a headright. In order to give people clear title to the land, someone had to go out with levels, chains, and surveyor's compasses and certify the claim. The Pinatica Comanches, predictably, hated them and went out of their way to hunt them down. It was probably the most dangerous job in North America. The year Hayes arrived, most of the men who did it were killed by Indians. Still, the job appealed to Hayes, who was after adventure as much as wages. Surveying parties began to include not only the surveyors, but armed guards for the surveyors, as well as adventuresome types who just felt like tagging along, exploring the land, doing some hunting, and possibly shooting an Indian. For the fearless, the unattached, and the rough and ready, it was a good time to be living in San Antonio, Texas. The land on the edge of the Balcones Escarpment was strikingly beautiful. There were gentle live oak savannas, and in the spring, they exploded into a rainbow spectrum of wildflowers. Game abounded: buffalo, bear, deer, antelope, wild turkeys, sandhill cranes, coyotes, wolves, and deer by the tens of thousands. The crystal-clear limestone rivers like the Llano, the Guadalupe, the Pedernales, and the San Marcos were jumping with fish. Plenty of these young men died hard deaths in their new paradise, including Hayes's own cousin. Hayes was undeterred. He did quite a bit of surveying. In 1838, he successfully surveyed 76 headrights. He also began to make a name for himself as an Indian fighter, especially one who knew how to keep his men alive. According to one writer who knew him, "The little Tennessean would seem to be another man when the cry 'Indians' was raised. He would mount a horse and assume the appearance of a different being. With him, it was charge and war to the knife, and the Indians were whipped every time they attacked his party." Like Grant in the Civil War, Hayes worried less about what his adversaries could do to him than about what damage he could inflict on them. Like Grant, too, he was all about offense. In conversation, he was soft-spoken and well-mannered. In a fight, he was cold as ice and firmly in command of men who quickly deferred to him. Having made his name keeping surveyors alive, he began to ride with the new ranging companies, who were often the same people who went out to guard surveying teams. We know that he fought at the Battle of Plum Creek, and that he was part of the ill-fated Moore expedition of 1839 that returned ignominiously home on foot. We do not know much more about his first years. But he had clearly distinguished himself. In 1840, at the age of 23, Hayes became captain of the San Antonio Station of the Rangers, a force that had been officially established by the Texas Republic, but was still required to furnish its own arms, equipment, horses, and even food. There was no pay at first. Later, it would be set at $30 a month, when it arrived at all. The Rangers as an organization existed only intermittently, living from congressional authorization to authorization, often disbanding, then reforming. Considering the life expectancy of the new Indian fighters, 2 years at the outside, it was a job not everyone would have wanted. And yet changes were already taking place that were shifting the odds. No one knew this better than Hayes. For one thing, the new breed of ranger, the Hayes Ranger, knew how to ride. And he was mounted on an agile and fast horse, the product of local breeding of Mustangs with Kentucky, Virginia, and Arabian strains. Those horses were heavier than the Indian mounts, but they could run with the Mustangs and keep up with them over long distances. It was said that Hayes would not accept any recruit whose horse was worth less than $100. Under Hayes, the ranging companies, rarely numbering more than 15 or 20 men, began to behave more and more like the people they were hunting. "They moved as lightly over the prairie as the Indians did," wrote Caperton, "and lived as they did, without tent, with a saddle for a pillow at night." Hayes, in particular, paid a good deal of attention both to his Comanche foes and to his Lipan Apache scouts, learning from them how to ride, fight, track, make camp. Each man had a rifle, 2 pistols, and a knife. He had a Mexican blanket secured behind his saddle and a small wallet in which he carried salt and cold flour and tobacco. That was all. Like Comanches, the Rangers often traveled by moonlight, navigating by river courses and the North Star, and dispensing with fires altogether, making cold camps, and eating hardtack or other uncooked rations. Hayes's men would sleep fully clothed and fully armed, ready to fight at a minute's notice. They crossed rivers even in freezing weather, swimming by the side of their horses. None of this behavior had any precedent in American military history. No cavalry anywhere could bridle and saddle a horse in less time than the Rangers. Some of this came naturally to these young men, but some of it was the result of training. Hayes insisted that his men practice both shooting and riding. One drill involved setting 2 6-foot-high posts in the ground, 40 yards apart. The ranger would ride toward them at full speed, fire his rifle at the first post and his pistols at the second. Before long, they were able to hit a ring on the post that was the size of a man's head. Note that these men were charging and shooting on horseback, a concept taken entirely from Plains Indians. They probably started to do this sometime between 1838 and 1840. Whenever the transition took place, it was done in direct imitation of the Comanches' own style and represented an enormous advance in anti-Indian warfare. The Rangers were the only ones in America who could do anything like that from the saddle, and they were absolutely the only ones who could do it in battle. It came from pure necessity. No one who had fought Comanches could possibly believe that there was any advantage to fighting them dismounted on open ground. Riding drills were even more elaborate. In a contemporary description by one of Hayes's men, "After practicing for 3 or 4 months, we became so perfect that we would run our horses half or full speed and pick up a hat, a coat, a blanket, or rope, or even a silver dollar, stand up in the saddle, throw ourselves on the side of our horses with only a foot and a hand to be seen, and shoot our pistols under the horse's neck, rise up and reverse, etc. What Hayes mainly understood was the value of pure audacity, of striking fear and panic in his opponents' hearts. He was still at a great disadvantage in weaponry. Each of his men had only 3 shots before they had to stop and reload, an activity that could not be done easily on horseback. Thus, his rangers struck quickly and hard, often from ambush and often at night, overcoming their odds with a pure and reckless charge. "The one idea rules," wrote contemporary Victor Rose. "Make a rapid, noiseless march, strike the foe while he was not on the alert, punish him, crush him." In the fall of 1840, Hayes and 20 men encountered a party of 200 Comanches at a crossing of the Guadalupe River near San Antonio. The Comanches had stolen a large number of horses. Hayes put it this way to the men: "Yonder are the Indians, boys, and yonder are our horses. The Indians are pretty strong, but we can whip them. What do you say?" "Go ahead," the men replied. Their assumption, as always, was that Hayes would lead. "And we'll follow if there's 1,000 of them." The Indians, very likely in disbelief that white people would be crazy enough to take 10-to-1 odds against mounted Comanches in the wilderness, drew themselves into a battle line and waited for the small band to attack. The Texans charged furiously and discharged their 3 shots. The line of battle was thrown into confusion. In the scuffle, the head man was hit and killed. The Indians fled. In this way, Hayes and his small companies slammed into the Panatica in central Texas in engagements that were mostly unrecorded. Hayes preferred surprise, killing them, just as the Comanches preferred to do, in their villages while they slept. He had learned the fundamental lesson of plains warfare. It was either victory or death. The Indians gave no quarter, and the Rangers rarely did either. There was no expectation of honorable surrender. Hayes did not always win, though he was astoundingly successful in preserving the lives of his men. In one fight, he took 120 men and 15 to 20 Lipan Apaches into battle against a vastly larger force of Comanches, losing 20 to 30. In another, he took 50 Texans and 10 Lipans, engaged a larger force in a running fight for 1.5 hours. Hayes's horses faltered, then broke down, unable to stay with the Comanche ponies. Several of his men were wounded. According to his own report, Hayes was now out of provisions and was forced to subsist on his broken-down horses until they reached Bejar, San Antonio. He also learned quickly what would soon become his main advantage. Comanches were extremely predictable. They never changed their methods. They were deeply custom-bound and equally deeply mired in their notions of medicine and magic. They reacted to a given situation, such as the killing of their war chief or medicine man, in exactly the same way every time. In white man's terms, they were easily spooked. What Hayes did appeared to be unbelievably brave to men who did not have his ability to calculate odds. He was also, it must be said, unbelievably brave. Hayes had other attributes as well. He was extremely cautious where his men's safety was concerned, and almost motherly in his care of them when they were wounded. He was remarkably industrious in camp, hauling wood and water, staking and hobbling horses, cooking food. But when it was a mere question of personal danger, his bravery bordered closely on rashness. He had an iron constitution that made him seemingly impervious to discomfort, bad weather, or sleep deprivation. "I have frequently seen him sitting by his campfire at night in some exposed locality," wrote J.W. Wilbarger, "when rain was falling in torrents, or a cold norther with sleet or snow was whistling about his ears, apparently as unconscious of all discomfort as if he had been seated in some cozy room of a first-class city hotel. And this, perhaps, when all he had eaten for supper was a handful of pecans or a piece of hardtack." Though Hayes's exploits in battle were known along the border before his appointment to captain in 1840, 2 battles in 1841 established his fame on the frontier. The first involved Mexicans. With 25 men, Hayes routed a superior force of cavalry near Laredo, took 25 prisoners, and captured 28 horses. He did it on sheer nerve, ordering his men to dismount, advance on the enemy, and to hold their fire well beyond where any normal skirmishers would have dared. Hayes, as always, led the charge. At 60 yards, 40 yards within the range of their accurate Kentucky rifles, they finally opened up. The Mexicans fled, and the Rangers, without waiting to reload, drew their pistols, jumped on the horses the Mexicans had abandoned, and pursued them. The defeat caused a panic in Laredo, many of whose residents jumped the Rio Grande in fear of their lives. When Hayes approached the city, its alcalde came out with a white flag to beg the Rangers to spare the town. They did. They would not always be so kind. In Mexico City in 1847, they once executed 80 men in reprisal for the death of one Ranger. The second involved, as most of his fighting did, Comanches. In the summer of 1841, a Comanche war party came down on the settlements around San Antonio, raiding and killing and stealing horses. Hayes, with one of the Texas Congress's intermittent appropriations in hand, raised a company of 13 men and rode after them, trailing them about 70 miles westward from San Antonio to the mouth of Uvalde Canyon. Hayes found the Indians by using a trick he had learned from the Lipans. He simply followed the large flock of vultures that circled in a towering spiral over the Comanches' bloody mittens. Near the camp, Hayes spotted and engaged a dozen Comanches. The Rangers charged, and the Indians took cover in a woody thicket. Hayes immediately understood the implications of what his opponents had done. Their arrows would be of little or no use to them in such dense brush. He then ordered his men to surround the thicket and shoot anyone who came out. Though he was wounded in the hand, he took two men with him and went into the thicket. He was later joined by a third, where they fought a four-hour battle with the Indians, killing 10 of them. Hayes himself made a rare and casually chilling report on it to the Texas Secretary of War. The Indians had but one gun, and the thicket being too dense to admit their using their arrows well, they fought under great disadvantage, but continued to struggle to the last, keeping up their war songs until they were all hushed in death. Being surrounded by horsemen, ready to cut them down if they left the thicket, and unable to use their arrows with much effect in their situation, their fate was inevitable. They saw it, and met it like heroes. It was an astonishing display of warrior prowess. For it, Hayes was promoted to major. He was not yet 25. Despite his success fighting Comanches, Hayes still faced one very large and intractable problem. His single-shot, hard-to-reload rifles and old-style pistols put him at a severe disadvantage against Comanches who carried 20 arrows in their quivers. There was no way around it. He had tried to adapt the long rifle to mounted use, and it actually worked minor miracles, but it was still a clumsy weapon that was best fired and reloaded on the ground. It was still the old backwoods rifle from Pennsylvania via Kentucky. Its shortcomings accounted, in large part, for the berserk aggressiveness of Hayes's Rangers in battle. To stand pat was to be soon peppered with iron-tipped arrows. Headlong attack, for all of its risks, remained a far safer idea. Meanwhile, back in the civilized, industrializing East, an enterprise was underway that would soon solve Hayes's problem, and in so doing, change the world, but for now was mired in failure and obscurity. In 1830, a 16-year-old with big ideas and a knack for intricate mechanics named Samuel Colt had carved his first model of a revolving pistol out of wood. 6 years later, he took out a patent on it. In 1838, a company in Paterson, New Jersey, began to manufacture Colt's patented firearms. Among them was a .36-caliber, five-chambered revolving pistol with an octagonal barrel and a concealed trigger that dropped down when the gun was cocked. It was not the first such idea, but it was believed to be the first that was put into production for general use. There was just one problem with the new gun. No one wanted it. The weapon's natural market, the U.S. government, could not see any application and refused to subsidize it. The weapon had the feel of a cavalry sidearm, but just then the U.S. Army did not have a cavalry. Nor did the new pistol seem to interest private citizens. It was a nifty, if somewhat impractical, product. Oddly, the only people who wanted it were in the exotic and faraway Republic of Texas. In 1839, President Mirabeau Lamar directed the Texas Navy, of all things, to order 180 five-shot Colt revolvers from the Patent Arms Manufacturing Company in Patterson. Later, the Texas Army ordered another 40. The pistols were shipped and paid for. There is no particular evidence that they were ever used by sailors or anyone else in the service of the Texas government. It seemed to be an obscure and impractical weapon destined for an obscure and irrelevant branch of the Texas military, such as it was, and there they languished. No one knows exactly how these revolvers came into the hands of Jack Hayes and his Rangers, but they most certainly did. In later correspondence with Colt, Samuel Walker, one of Hayes's most celebrated lieutenants, placed the date sometime in 1843. This is probably accurate, since that was the year Sam Houston disbanded the Navy. Whenever the event took place, the Rangers immediately grasped the significance of such weapons. To them, Colt's contraption was a revelation, a multi-shot weapon that could be used from horseback, and thus, at long last, even the odds. Though there is no record of it, Hayes and his men must have spent long hours practicing with the new weapons and figuring out what they could do. And they must have spent many nights around the campfire discussing the revolver's strengths and weaknesses. The new Colt revolver had many weaknesses. It was fragile. The bullets it fired were of a light caliber when a heavier load, 44 caliber or larger, was needed. It was not terribly accurate except at close range. It employed pre-loaded cylinders, which meant that a Ranger armed with two pistols and four cylinders had 40 shots. But the cylinders were difficult to change, and when they were empty, a man in the field could not reload them. That, however, did not change the basic astounding fact of a revolving chamber. Hayes and the rest of his Rangers, notably Ben McCulloch and Samuel Walker, were convinced of its potential. By the spring of 1844, they were ready to give Colt's unpopular oddball revolver its first combat test. That test came to be known as the Battle of Walker's Creek, a minor military engagement that became one of the defining moments in the history of Texas and of the American West. Indeed, it can be argued that before Jack Hayes arrived in San Antonio, Americans in the West went about largely on foot and carried Kentucky rifles. By the time he left in 1849, anybody going west was mounted and carrying a holstered six-shooter. Walker's Creek was the beginning of that change. In early June 1844, Hayes and 15 men were scouting the upper courses of the Pedernales and Llano. They were in the hill country, west of Austin and San Antonio, the Panatica heartland. Finding nothing, they headed back toward home. On June 8th, they stopped to gather honey from a bee tree on Walker's Creek, a tributary of the Guadalupe River and about 50 miles north of San Antonio. Hayes, meanwhile, had dispatched two of his men to lag behind the group and see if they were being followed. This was an old Indian practice. Hayes had learned many old Indian practices. The two men soon dashed into camp and breathlessly reported that they had found 10 sets of Indian horse tracks behind them. The company quickly saddled up and countermarched in the direction of the Indians. As they approached, three or four Indians made a great show of alarm and then an even greater show of fleeing for their lives. Another old Indian trick. Hayes did not fall for it, and he did not pursue them. Soon, the rest of the body of Panaticas, 75 of them, showed themselves. The Texans advanced slowly, while the Indians fell back to the top of a steep hill, a superb defensive redoubt in the broken, rocky country timbered with live oak. From there, they taunted the rangers, yelling in Spanish and English, "Charge! Charge!" Hayes obliged them, though not exactly in the way they had imagined. Realizing that he and his 14 men were temporarily concealed at the base of the hill, he turned his little band and galloped at full speed some 200 to 300 yards, circled the bottom of the hill, emerged behind the Indians, and charged their flank. Taken by surprise, the Comanches still managed to recover quickly. They split their forces and wheeled on the Texans on both flanks, yelling loudly. Under normal circumstances, their assault would have broken the Ranger battle line. It would have routed them. But in a remarkable display of horsemanship and raw, bone-rattling courage, the Rangers formed a circle with their horses and thus, rump to rump, received the charge. What happened next, 75 Panatica Comanches on 15 Rangers, arrows and lances against repeating pistols, sounds like pure, bloody pandemonium. Several Rangers were badly wounded. Their pistols, meanwhile, were dropping Indians from the saddle at an alarming rate. This stage of the fight lasted 15 minutes. Then the Indians broke and fled. It became a running fight and went for more than an hour on over 2 miles of rough terrain. Urged on by their heroic chief, the Indians kept rallying, regrouping, and attacking, only to be overwhelmed by the Rangers' fire-spitting Colt revolvers. 40 Indians were now dead or wounded. One Ranger was dead, and 4 were wounded. Still, the fight went on as the Indian leader rallied his men again and again. Then, as though to illustrate the five-shooter's main weakness, Hayes's men ran out of ammunition. More precisely, they had run out of preloaded cylinders, which could not be reloaded in the field, and no one had anything but five-shooters. They were now at the mercy of the 35 remaining Indians, or at least they would be when the Indians figured out their ammunition had run out. Hayes then coolly called out to see if anyone had any bullets left. One man, Robert Gillespie, rode forward and said he did. "Dismount and shoot the chief," ordered Hayes. This Gillespie did. At a range of 30 steps, he dropped the chief from his saddle. The remaining Indians, in wild affright at the loss of their leader, scattered in every direction in the brushwood. When the smoke had cleared, 20 Comanches were dead and another 30 were wounded. Hayes had suffered one man killed and 3 seriously wounded. One of his main lieutenants, Samuel Walker, was pinned to the ground with a Comanche lance. The Rangers made camp there to care for their wounded. 3 days later, 4 Comanches showed up, perhaps to reclaim their dead. Hayes attacked once more, killing 3 of them. Though it would take a while for everyone else on the frontier to understand what happened at Walker's Creek, and it would take the Mexican War to make the U.S. government understand what it meant, a fundamental, paradigm-shattering change had occurred. The Indians now faced the prospect of being blasted from horseback by guns that never emptied. The whites could now fight entirely mounted against their foes with weapons whose frequency of firing nearly matched that of the Comanches. The odds had been evened up. Or better. Up to this time, Samuel Walker wrote in a letter to Samuel Colt in 1846, these daring Indians had always supposed themselves superior to us, man to man, on horse. The result of this engagement was such as to intimidate them and enable us to treat with them. Still, no one outside of the Republic of Texas understood what Sam Colt had done. In 1844, fully 6 years after he had begun to produce his repeating pistols, his invention was a failure. The Paterson, New Jersey factory went into bankruptcy in 1842. Colt managed to keep his patents, but little else. The models, prototypes, and plans for his six-shooters were all lost or destroyed. He spent 5 years in poverty. But there was hope, and Colt knew it. Word of what Hayes and his men were doing with the revolver had reached him in the East. He was so excited that in the fall of 1846, he wrote Samuel Walker in Texas
With a few inquiries regarding your experience in the use of my repeating firearm and your opinion as their adaptation to the military service in the war against Mexico, I have heard so much of Colonel Hayes and your exploits with the arms of my invention that I have long desired to know you personally and get from you a true narrative of the various instances where my arms have proved of more than ordinary utility." Walker wrote back immediately and enthusiastically with a description of how effective the revolvers had been at the Battle of Walker's Creek. "With improvements," he concluded, "I think they can be rendered the most perfect weapon in the world for mounted troops." From here, Sam Colt's prospects began very quickly to improve. The war in Mexico had started, and the Texas Rangers had volunteered for it and had been accepted by General Zachary Taylor. They were soon fighting south of the border. They made an extraordinary impression on the U.S. Army in Mexico. They were like nothing anyone had ever seen. They wore no uniforms, provided their own weapons and equipment, and went everywhere mounted. Unlike almost everyone else in the Army, they preferred to fight mounted. They served mainly as spies and scouts, effectively transferring the style of warfare they had learned from the Comanches to the land south of the border, and tales of their bravery, toughness, and resourcefulness spread from the Mexican War around the world. Samuel Walker's swashbuckling dash with 75 men through a field held by 1,500 Mexican cavalry, or Colonel Jack Hayes's savage efficiency in clearing the roads of Mexican guerrillas, were told and retold in salons from Chicago to New York. General Taylor complained of their lawlessness, but the fact of the matter was that the enemy was terrified of them. Everyone was terrified of them. The most striking thing of all about them was their weaponry, their five-shot Colts, and their ability to wield them with deadly accuracy from horseback, were the wonder of the Army. So much so that the Army now wanted more, 1,000 of them, to be exact, enough to supply all of the Rangers and other Texans in Mexico. There was just one problem. Colt had not made a revolver of any kind for 5 years. He had no money, and he had no factory to make them. He did not even have a working model of one of his pistols. He even advertised in the New York newspapers, without success, trying to find one. Still, he offered to sell the Army 1,000 of them for $25 apiece. With a contract in hand, in January 1847, he convinced his friend Eli Whitney to make the pistols. Now all he had to do was design a brand new weapon. And then something remarkable happened. Colt asked Samuel Walker, who happened to be temporarily stationed in Washington, to help him with the design. Colt wrote, "I have suggested the propriety of your coming to see me before I commence the construction of these arms. Get from the department an order to come to New York and direct in the construction of these arms with the improvements you suggest." Thus the two men, the hardened Ranger from the Texas frontier and the ambitious young Connecticut Yankee, became collaborators. Walker was full of ideas. He explained to Colt that he needed a bigger caliber and that the gun had to be heavier, more rugged, with a longer barrel and a longer and fuller handle. His refinements could be quite specific, too. In a letter to Colt on February 19, 1847, he recommended making the hind sight much finer and the front sight of German silver and of a shape altogether different. It was Colt's idea to use 6 chambers instead of 5. The result, the Walker Colt, was one of the most effective and deadly pieces of technology ever devised, one that would soon kill more men in combat than any sidearm since the Roman short sword. It was a small cannon. It had an enormous 9-inch barrel and weighed in at 4 pounds 9 ounces. Its revolving chambers held conical 44 caliber bullets that weighed 220 grains each. The powder charge, 50 grains of black powder, made the new Colt pistol as deadly as a rifle up to 100 yards. Engraved on its barrel, this was Sam Colt's gift to the Rangers, was an etching of the Battle of Walker's Creek, as Samuel Walker had described it to him. Needless to say, the Colts in the hands of Texans, but especially Hayes's Rangers, were devastating. The sight of a Ranger on horseback, flashing Walker Colt in hand, is one of the indelible images from the Mexican War. It, of course, saved Colt. Though he lost a few $1,000s on this deal, he later became one of the richest men in the country. Samuel Walker died a hero on October 9, 1847, in Huamantla, Mexico, from a sniper's bullet. 11. War to the Knife. In the pleasant, cool October air, in a lovely prairie upland, by a clear spring in a place no Taibo had ever been, the woman called Nauta set about the very hard work of dismantling 1,500-pound buffaloes. This was women's work, as was almost anything to do with a buffalo that did not involve tracking it and killing it. Comanche women cut the meat into strips for drying. They tanned the hides and made the robes and harvested the paunch and the sinew and the marrow from the bones and the ground-up brains and every other part of the huge beasts that were, collectively, the foundations of Nemenu existence. Women did everything else, too, it seemed. They cooked and tended to the children and horses and did the packing when the pasturage ran out or the enemies got too close. They fought, too, usually only defensively. They went along with raiding parties. Nauta did this. It is impossible to say if Nauta was happy or if happiness had any place in her expectations of life, which amounted to an endless and unyielding progression of hard tasks. There were occasional joys. Children were joys. She had three of them. The oldest, a large, strong boy named Quana, was 12. His brother Peanuts was a few years younger. And there was a beautiful little girl, Totsia, Prairie Flower, who was just a toddler. If there was such a thing as happiness on the crude frontier, she was very likely happy with her marriage, too. Her husband, Pita Nukona, was an enormous, muscular, dark-skinned man and a prominent war chief. She enjoyed his elevated social status. She enjoyed the fruits of his hunting. He was a great raider and had many horses, which made them, in plains terms, rich. She had to share him with only one other wife, a full-blood Comanche woman. This was October 1860. Though the United States of America was a month away from electing Abraham Lincoln and thus setting in motion political events that would break the nation apart and spill the blood of a million men, none of this was apparent to Nauta or her family. She and her people could read the presence of white men. They were extraordinarily tuned to the presence or absence of military power, to the pulse and increase of settlement, or to the presence or absence of military will. They understood when the game did not return to the hunting grounds. But they saw everything from the remoteness of the plains, still a vast piece of the American continent's midsection, where much of life continued amazingly, as it had before. Nauta lived a life with her family that was not unlike the life of a Comanche woman in 1760, or in many ways, 1660. There were still buffalo. The Comanches still made war. They were still unchallenged in 95% of the old homelands. The listener may well wonder how it is possible to see into a Comanche camp on the remote plains in a place where no white men lived or traveled. But the preceding account is not fictional in any sense. Though Cynthia Ann Parker was hard to track, and as time went by she was becoming an ever more distant memory on the fast-changing frontier, in October 1860 her whereabouts are known precisely. We know exactly where she was, who she was with, and what she was doing, and where she was camped within a few hundred yards. Her circumstances are known because of the events of the next 2 months and because of the bloody catastrophe that was about to befall her, a fate that, twinned with her capture in the 1836 raid, made the woman born as Cynthia Ann Parker one of the least lucky people in the world. She herself had no inkling of what was going to happen. She was doing what she had always done and had a few months yet to enjoy the immemorial life of a Nemenu woman. She was living in a large Comanche camp, one that contained as many as 500 people. It was something more than a nomadic camp, though. It was more like an operations base and supply depot for many different raiding parties, a sort of swing station through which supplies moved, as well as plunder, cattle, and horses, on their way to markets elsewhere. The camp was also a relay for stolen horses. This was Indian logistics on a large scale. There were prodigious amounts of everything, from horses to shoes and sausages, suggesting a degree of planning and orchestration that the Comanches were not known to possess. Here is what was later found at the camp. A large amount of dried beef and buffalo meat, buffalo skins, an enormous amount of buffalo rugs, cooking utensils, axes, knives, tomahawks, tools for dressing skins, wooden bowls, moccasins, whetstones, leather bags filled with marrow out of bones and brains, little sacks of soup, sausages, guts stuffed with tallow and brains, and various other things. The Comanche camp was located near the Pease River, which originates in the Texas Panhandle and snakes westward along the northern corridor of Texas and joins the Red River. Before that confluence, south of the present-day town of Quanah and 10 or 12 miles northeast of the town of Crowell, a clear, spring-fed stream called Mule Creek enters the Pease in a long valley framed by rugged hills and oak and cottonwood and hackberry trees. Nauta's village was a mile back from where the crystalline Mule Creek met the salty, gypsum-laced waters of the Pease, strung out for a few hundred yards in a cottonwood grove along the creek. The country was pretty, spare. Wide, high prairie plains were broken by the river and the hills and the steep ridges that rose from the creek. The village was roughly 125 miles west of the line of settlement, which in the autumn of 1860 ran just west of today's Fort Worth. What Nauta did was bloody, messy work. Sometimes she was covered from head to toe in buffalo fat, blood, marrow, and tissue, so much so that it turned her naturally light hair and light skin almost black. So much so that it would have been hard to spot her as the white woman in the Indian camp. While she worked, she watched her children. She was still nursing her daughter, Prairie Flower. Her boys played. They were old enough to hunt now, too, and sometimes they went out with their father. Peter Nakona, meanwhile, spent his time hunting and raiding. His raiding habits are known, too. Through the summer and early fall, he led a series of sweeping, devastating raids into the counties between present-day Fort Worth and Wichita Falls, Texas. There is more than a bit of irony in the fact that one of his chief targets, Parker County, was named for his wife's uncle, Isaac Parker, yet another prominent Parker who lived in the county seat of Weatherford. Parker had arrived in Texas in 1833 with his father, Elder John, and brothers Daniel, Silas, and James, and the rest of the Parker clan. He had served Texas as an elected representative or state senator almost continuously from 1837 to 1857. He had been instrumental in passing the bill for the new county in 1855. He was wealthy, exceedingly handsome, with chiseled features. He was widely known as a storyteller. Peter Nakona, of course, did not know any of this. And now he had come to plunder his in-law's creation. From all accounts, most of Nakona's raids came at night, by the light of what was already widely referred to in Texas as a Comanche moon. According to Parker County resident Hillary Bedford, people on moonlit nights were in perfect dread. "I well remember the time when the beautiful nights of the full moon, instead of being a source of pleasure, were, on the contrary, to be dreaded as the worst of evils." Whole families and settlements were wiped out. Families with the names Youngblood and Rippey, lost forever to history, ceased to exist, leaving as monuments smoking, burned-out cabins and bodies mutilated beyond recognition. The raiders stole cattle and horses. Most of the raiding in those days involved stealing. Bedford attributed the raids to Peter Nakona. Because this area was their old hunting ground, Nakona and his warriors knew the land intimately. Moving by night, they were almost impossible to apprehend. The raids were remarkable, too, because the panicked whites in that arc of settlement west of Fort Worth did not seem to be able to do anything to stop them. In March of 1860, Governor Sam Houston had authorized Colonel Middleton T. Johnson to raise a regiment of Rangers to punish the Indians on the state's northern and northwestern frontiers. Though Rip Ford had won a splendid victory on Antelope Creek 2 years before and had wanted to continue to pursue Comanches in their heartland, his funding had been cut off. Now, Johnson raised 5 companies. They rode north to Fort Belknap, where they installed themselves. It is not clear exactly who Johnson recruited or what his standards were. But these men were very clearly not the old Hays Rangers. While they waited hopefully for Indian raids, they were engulfed in boredom. They drank. They fought each other with fists and knives, played poker, and hunted buffalo. Colonel Johnson at one point took a long leave of absence to get married in Galveston. In June, one drunken ranger shot another and wounded him. Another was said to have been murdered by local desperados or deserted. It was hard to tell which. The men held dances at which they took both male and female parts. They hunted buffalo. When they finally took to the field, 300 strong, they could not find any Indians. During the summer, Johnson and his men were outfoxed, outrun, and generally humiliated in ways that would have amazed the old Rangers. According to one account, after one of their unsuccessful forays, they had started for home. Though they could not find Peter Nocona, he apparently had no trouble finding them. At night, the Indians charged the Ranger camp, stampeded the horses, and drove them away, leaving the white men to return home across the plains on foot. On another occasion, while the Rangers were riding north toward Oklahoma, Indians swept around south of them, stealing 75 horses and killing several settlers during a 4-day spree. The Rangers turned, vowing to wipe them out. Instead, the Indians set the prairie on fire, destroying horse forage and causing the white men to return to Fort Belknap. The failure of Johnson's unit illustrated an old truth in the West, that knowledge of how to fight Comanches spread, at best, sporadically and unevenly along the frontier. There were things that Jack Hays knew in 1839 that Rangers in general still had not learned 20 years later. The people on the frontier were furious. John Baylor, the flamboyant, vehemently anti-Indian editor of the Weatherford paper The White Man, insulted the Rangers by calling them perfectly harmless, declaring that their hiring was the most stupendous sell practiced on the frontier people, and that all of their expectations have resulted only in the Rangers eating twice their weight in beef at 11 cents a pound, drinking bad water, and cursing the day they were induced to soldier for glory, in a campaign that has resulted in the killing of 2 citizens and the marriage of the colonel of the regiment. It further stated that if he and his people found one of them, especially Johnson, they would hang him. Johnson, meanwhile, seemed more interested in his blossoming love affair with the lovely socialite Louisa Power Givens. His unsuccessful expeditions that summer offer a good example of what happened when white men wrote the history of the Indian Wars. Johnson gets scant mention in Ranger histories. There is very little detail on his expeditions. He is dismissed with a shrug. No one is much interested in the abject humiliation of the institution of the Texas Rangers. If Indians had been writing about the northwest frontier of Texas in 1860, they might have characterized Peter Nocona's attacks as tactically brilliant guerrilla warfare, in the same way historians would later speak of the daring exploits of Confederate raider Nathan Bedford Forrest. Flush with victory, scalps, cattle, and horses, Nocona returned to his camp on Mule Creek and rejoined his wife and 3 children. In late November, he rode eastward again to the frontier, this time at the head of 55 warriors. This time the raiding was worse, crueler, more vengeful even than it had been in the early fall. His war party swung west of Mesquiteville, now Jacksboro, and rode hard into the line of settlements, killing everyone they saw. Near Weatherford, they attacked the ranch of John Brown, stealing his horses, killing him by driving lances through every part of his body, and cutting off his nose. They rode across open country in a torrential rain and arrived at a place called Stag Prairie, on the western edge of Parker County. Here, on the very outermost edge of the bleeding frontier, in the most hazardous place in the state of Texas, a greenhorn named Ezra Sherman, who did not even own a gun, had decided to move his wife, Martha, and three children. On November 26th, a group of 17 Braves from Nocona's force arrived at the Sherman home. The Shermans were having dinner at the time. The Indians entered the cabin, actually shook hands with the family, then asked for something to eat. The Shermans, nervous and unsure what was happening, gave the Indians their table. Once they had eaten, the Indians turned the family out, though with continuing professions of goodwill. "Vamoos," they said. "No hurt. Vamoos." The Sherman's 7-year-old son fled and hid himself. The others got away as fast as they could, stumbling in the driving rain across their fields toward a nearby farm. They weren't fast enough. Half a mile from their house, the Indians reappeared. Now they seized Martha, who was 9 months pregnant. While Ezra and his two children continued on, they dragged Martha back to a point about 200 yards from the cabin. There she was gang-raped. When they were finished, they shot several arrows into her and then did something that was unusually cruel, even for them. They scalped her alive by making deep cuts below her ears and, in effect, peeling the top of her head entirely off. As she later explained, this was difficult for the Indians to do and took a long time to accomplish. Bleeding, she managed to drag herself back inside her house, which the heavy rain had prevented the Indians from burning, where her husband found her. She lived 4 days, during which time she was coherent enough to tell the story to her neighbors. She gave birth to a stillborn infant. She probably died of peritonitis. Comanches knew what it was and often aimed their arrows at a victim's navel. Half a century later, a Palo Pinto County rancher recalled that her scalping left her a fearful sight. She was one of 23 people who died by the hand of Pita Nakona's raiders over a span of 2 days, November 26th to November 28th. Frontier people saw Martha Sherman's death as the random and senseless slaughter of a Christian woman by a tribe whose primitive, godless, and subhuman nature it was to do such things. Mrs. Sherman hadn't hurt anyone. She had committed no acts of war, but her death was neither random nor senseless. She was as much a victim of colliding political and social forces as she was of the arrows and knives of Pita Nakona's raiders. Her death did mean something. It was a consequence of the unprecedented invasion of Comancheria by white settlers that had taken place at the end of the 1850s. The land she lived on was not the hardscrabble hills of Edwards Plateau, west of Austin and San Antonio, where the buffalo herd rarely roamed. This was lush, open, long grass prairie beyond the cross timbers in northern Texas, and encompassed the rich and ancient buffalo ground that Comanches had been fighting for since the early 18th century. Pioneers had been gradually pushing westward behind a line of federal forts that had been built in the early 1850s. But the big rush came at the end of the decade, when white settlement leapfrogged 50 miles to a line of longitude that passes through present-day Wichita Falls, way beyond where the white people had ever gone before. The newly chinked cabins in Parker County were part of this swelling presence. And though Martha Sherman was undoubtedly a well-intentioned and God-fearing woman, she and Ezra were part of that clamorous, chaotic, and brazenly aggressive lunge into the enemy's territory. The Comanches saw it that way because there was no other way for them to see it. That fall, the buffalo had moved south, bumping up against the white man's homesteads, meaning that Comanches who stayed away from the frontier were going hungry. Pita Nakona's brutal sweep through northern Texas was thus a political act with political objectives. So was the Shermans' decision to build their cabin in western Parker County, though less self-consciously so. Both coveted the same land, both wanted the other side to stop contesting it, and neither was willing to give anything meaningful in exchange. By comparison, what happened at Parker's Fort was minor contact between picket lines. The raids of Pita Nakona in 1860 constituted outright war for territory. Everything was at stake now. Everything was changing. Exploding might be a better word. When Cynthia Ann Parker was taken from her family in 1836, the population of Texas was around 15,000. By 1860, it had grown to 604,215. In the 1850s alone, some 400,000 new people had arrived. Fully 42,422 of Texas's residents that year were foreign-born. 182,921 of them were slaves. San Antonio was a bustling town of 8,235. Galveston, Houston, and Austin were all booming, transforming themselves from mud traps where pigs roamed the streets into something that began to look like urban civilization. In 1836, there were only a few rutted dirt wagon roads in Texas. By 1860, there were thousands of miles of such roads, plus 272 miles of railroad tracks. There were three newspapers when the Parker captives disappeared into the plains. Now, there were 71. Still, the state's population was mostly rural, and most of its citizens were subsistence farmers. On the outer frontier, they built primitive dog-run cabins or sod huts, made everything themselves except for tools and weapons, and scratched out a hard and meager living from the land. They endured many of the horrors that settlers on the Appalachian frontier had endured a century before. And they kept coming on in spite of this, from Alabama and Tennessee and other points east, piling up by the thousands on the edge of the plains barrier that had stood inviolable for so long. The problem, as Pita Nakona's raid illustrated, was that they were still being eviscerated, tortured, raped, and made captive by Comanches, and there was little evidence that anyone in the Office of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C., had the remotest idea of what to do about it. It seemed impossible that 21 years after Jack Hayes and the Rangers started fighting Indians in new ways, this could be the case. Every so often, troops would be sent forth with the glorious task of breaking Comanche power forever. Every so often, they would actually find Comanches and kill a significant number of them. But these expeditions never added up to anything. They didn't stop anything. There was no concerted will to pursue the adversaries into their dark heartland, to destroy them. And so the attacks continued, increasing in severity after 1857. Most came from the Yamparica, Kotsutika, Nokoni, and Quahati bands, who remained as free as ever in their strongholds in the far north or far west. Kiowas, equally untouchable above the Canadian River, were raiding too, often in tandem with Comanches. The old patterns reasserted themselves, only slightly altered, and nothing really changed. The great wave of American settlement had swept forward from the eastern coastlands through the Trans-Appalachian country and on past the Mississippi. It had a brief moment of hope and optimism, sailing across the 98th meridian with the Shermans and other settlers. And suddenly, it had crashed and burned yet again on the same vast and deadly physical barrier that had stopped the Spanish, the French, the Mexicans, and the original Texans, the Great Plains. On them, stretching clear to Canada, remained the formidable war machines of the Sioux, Arapaho, Comanche, Kiowa, and Cheyenne.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.